Hi, Doug.
Hey.
Well, I'm talking to Douglas Rushkoff, who has a book called Life Incorporated. And I'm Ann Altas, as you may know. I'm at the University of Wisconsin Law School, but currently on a front porch on the edge of Appalachia. And I think this idea of a sense of place is something that's going to tie to your book, Doug. So I wanted to start by asking you to say where you are physically.
I am in the basement of my home in Hastings-on-Hudson, New York. I'm looking at my own picture and not at yours. We're talking on the phone, but recording into our computers. So it's kind of an interesting interesting sensation.
And people who watch Blogging Heads get the feeling that we're looking each other in the face, but we're really, at most, only looking at ourselves in the face. Or
I know, which is actually an apt metaphor for my book in some ways.
It's like looking in the mirror. It's all about me, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But there's actually something in your book about how you ended up in that place. Is it Hastings on the Hudson?
Hastings on Hudson. I mean, I ended up here because, I mean the easiest way to say it is because I couldn't afford Brooklyn anymore.
But that stopped you. It didn't stop anyone else. The fact that you couldn't afford it made you
wouldn't afford it. You know, I mean, I had a bunch of friends who were saying, Doug, you just got to man up and borrow $900,000 to purchase a $1.4 million apartment. And somehow that didn't seem like manning up. That seemed to me, at least where I come from, I'm sort of the early Gen X, you know, buster slacker type. That seemed not like manning up, but like manning down, like surrendering to the man. And, you know, and I remember the morning I finally decided not to do it, not to listen to the mortgage broker and not to just get in because they could get me in. And I felt like I had just narrowly escaped, you know, disaster, that they almost got me. But then, you know, that if they had, I would have had to write very different kinds of books to try to support my my debt structure.
You make your dealings with the bank sound like some sort of medieval struggle with the devil, that the devil almost got you. And it made me think of some things in your book. You know, in your book, I put in the margin at one point, are you nostalgic about the Middle Ages? Were the Middle Ages better?
I'm not nostalgic for them. I'm kind of bummed that they are so maligned. I feel like there's been a great PR
job. So you're a PR guy. You're a PR guy, and you're doing PR for the Middle Ages.
In a way, yeah. I mean, I feel like there's been a lot of PR done for the Renaissance, and that's because the Renaissance brought us the kinds of economic innovations that we're still living with today. You know, the Renaissance brought us centralized currency and chartered monopolies, and really the financial framework for modern day corporatism. So it's sort of no surprise that we would look at this, you know, massive centralization of energy as, you know, a golden age, when actually it was the beginning of the end. You know, late medieval Europe was a tremendously prosperous place. People were building cathedrals with the budgets of small towns. That's how prosperous they were. And the problem was that kings weren't being let in on this prosperity. They didn't know how they could make money just by having money when everyone else was making money by creating value. So they really just made it illegal for people to do commerce with each other. They they created chartered corporations, which had monopolies over industries, and they created centralized currency so that people couldn't transact with local currencies anymore. You know,
so
then we got the plague.
Well, when we think about the Middle Ages, we look at the bad things, the plague, no dentists, and we just basically picture suffering horrible pain with no way out, short of death. But you're sort of reviving it. It represents a lot of the things that you feel are missing in life today. And that made me want to get to the question that I thought everyone would ask you, so I was a little hesitant to ask you, but in our phone conversation before this dialogue, you told me they don't always ask you this. The book is called Life Incorporated, but it has a subtitle, How the World Became a Corporation, and then there's a sub-subtitle, and how to take it back. And how the world became a corporation, is the world a corporation? What does that mean for you? I mean, there was a phrase I found later in the book that corporatism, there's a lot about corporatism, and corporatism defines the landscape. And I kind of linked those two ideas, so I want to encourage you to explain that, the sense in which you think that the world is a corporation for us now, or that there's something called corporatism that we need to somehow disaggregate ourselves from.
I mean, I feel that to make a long story short, that we've ended up adapting our environment to the needs of centralized corporate capital. You know, that to some extent, building a society around the needs of the market was a good idea, because, you know, we had this economic model, and the economic model requires growth, you know, at a certain interest rate. It's the metric of health is the GDP, and we need to see that go up. So we need to create a terrain. We need to create a society, a culture that supports this kind of growth. Now, as long as you're, you know, in 14th, 15th century Europe, taking over new countries and dominating new peoples, you know, that kind of growth works. And judgments aside, whether dominating other peoples is good or bad, it functioned. As long as you have a big environment to colonize, there's lots of land and resources to gather, it works. You know, as long as you've got, you know, more people to buy more things in less time, this works. But eventually you start running up against certain walls. So what you need to do then is look back at the world and say, well, how can we rejigger things to make people buy more stuff, to create more consumption and production? And that's really what FDR did back when he was, you know, well-meaning, left-leaning FDR, looked at all the returning war vets and thought, well, not only are these people potentially crazy because they've just been through war experiences, and I need to somehow placate them and create a situation that's going to that my psychologists and my staff psychologists would recommend is healthy for them. But I need to create a way to get the engines of manufacturing and industry back in motion. So he worked with the Levitt brothers to devise a new model of community, you know, and that's Levittown, where individual families are going to live in individual houses, and everyone's going to need to buy one of everything. And Levittown.
Now, can I stop you and ask you just a question at that point? Are you blaming suburbia on World War II and Roosevelt's belief that the returning veterans were on the verge of a nervous breakdown?
I'm blaming it on that. I mean, I'm blaming, crediting it, if you will,
But you're creating a causal connection between Roosevelt's belief that the returning veterans were, well, they were doing, and to come back to America, where the whole experience was so disorienting that they needed to be put in some special extra comfort, almost like a medicinal environment to keep them from losing it entirely.
Well, not just that. I mean, that on the one hand, and also they needed to be kept apart from one another. You know, it was believed that what happened in Nazi Germany and what was happening in Russia, too, in the communist revolution, were both the result of people massing, men massing together. So now if you have a whole bunch of military-trained young men with the ability to create large groups of people, you could get the kind of social unrest of, you know, the early labor movement. And they were concerned about this too. At the same time, they wanted these guys to be happy. And it was believed that the way to make people happy was, rather than having them, you know, congregate and share their distrust frustration, you put them each one in a nice, I mean, and it was thought, they didn't know that it would be isolating.
Yeah.
You know, put them in a nice house with a nice woman and a family. Keep the guy occupied with gardening. They put three fruit trees on every front lawn so the man would be working. Get them a mortgage so they're going to want to keep their job to pay their mortgage. Create a ladder of consumer products so that the person could be felt that, you know, real nirvana, that the true sense of satisfaction was just one more set of consumer purchases away.
You know, it's interesting to think about women in that environment. I mean, you're speaking as if the men were the main subject of everything. Give everyone a good woman, but some of us are women, of course. The idea that suburbia was designed to control or to mollify and keep men from ruining everything with their destructive impulses and so on, but it was out of the sort of suburban environment, perhaps, that the women's movement grew.
Right. Well, it was also women, I mean, had dangerously proven themselves capable of doing work during World War II.
Right.
I mean, and that was a problem, too, because now the men are coming home. We got to get the women out of the factory and get the men back in. So it was, you know, it was really on the woman's side, it was designed to create a new consumer culture out of, you know, post-war women. It was the Lucille Ball model, where the woman is supposed to go out shopping and aspiring to mm-hmm. better clothes and hats and appliances, and the guy is supposed to be trying to work really hard to make enough money for her to be able to do this.
Women rebelled against precisely all that excessive cocooning. I mean, it was such an extreme model, as you describe it, with Levittown and
right.
advertising and consumerism and this ladder of better right. and better products and so forth. If that actually was the fertile ground for the women's movement, then is the problem really as ironclad as – I don't think you really portray it that way, but the problem isn't really ironclad because the rebellion grows out of
– Well, it none of it actually worked. I mean, you know, the alienation of the worker from what he does, the disconnection of people from one another, you know, the replacement of our human relationships with brand relationships. First off, it's not seamless. And second, it's not satisfying. I mean, it doesn't work at all. I mean, what it's ended up doing is created, I mean, on the one hand, the acceptance of corporate values as the operating system of our world, but it hasn't led to satisfaction. It's led to, if anything, a kind of, you know, quiet desperation, cultism, you know, alcoholism, a third of our population on antidepressants. It hasn't worked, and that's why, you know, and it's funny. I mean, I started this book 4 years before the financial crisis, but it's why we're in the financial crisis today, because you can't operate a society on debt. You know, debt is not finally a good product. That the growth imperative of the kind of capitalism we've adopted, on the kind of currency we decided to use, is ultimately unsustainable, and it refuses to allow sustainable businesses to even exist in an economic environment that's dictated by debt.
Now, are you – so you're writing this book long before the current crisis began. You must have, in some sense, almost celebrated the collapse, or sometimes reading your book, at some points I thought – that you actually had this idea that I know some people in the Obama administration occasionally will assert that a crisis is an opportunity. And I was
right.
wondering the extent to which you saw a big silver lining to the current economic crisis, and you think that this is a kind of a chance for, would you call it something like spiritual renewal? I don't think you really use terms like that. You don't go New Age in this book at all, but I think that you are talking about people finding different values, and that consumerism or corporatism.
Well,
that was sort of two questions. One is a question about religion, and the other is a question about seeing opportunity in the crisis and being optimistic about economic collapse.
Right. I mean, when I started this book, I felt much more like an enemy of the people than anything else. You know, when a market is at its height 4 or 5 years ago, if you call attention to the fact that it's a Ponzi scheme of one form or another, if you, you know, start to question the underpinnings of people's 401k plans, you're going to be considered an enemy of the people. So, I mean, just as
they were all depending on the bubble continuing to expand, and nobody's
right.
supposed to talk about that it could pop.
Right, because it's not just – not only am I playing a spoil sport to the thing that they're involved in, but I'm also potentially, through my very words, that just talking about it might somehow pull the girders out from under this false construction. And it was bizarre. I mean, it's why, you know, when I got mugged and posted where I got mugged –
Yeah, tell us that story, because we haven't gone through that. You begin your book with an anecdote about you being mugged.
Right. I got mugged on Christmas Eve in front of my building in Park Slope, and I posted where and when I'd gotten mugged, and the first two emails I got on Christmas Eve within an hour were from people angry that I had posted the location of where I'd gotten mugged because this could negatively affect their property values. And these weren't even people necessarily thinking of selling their houses, but it was people whose relationship to place had become financial, people who looked at their homes as property rather than experiences. Mm-hmm. These aren't places they live. These are assets that they need to keep their value. Now, I don't blame anyone for wanting to maintain the property value of their home. I understand why you want to do that. But the fact that it was so short term, in other words, rather than making their neighborhood safer in the long term, they were more concerned with the brand value of their neighborhood because they're checking the moment-to-moment value of their property the way someone checks their stocks like on a daily basis, ready to sell it. And that, to my mind, is the way a corporation looks at its balance sheet and its assets rather than the way a human being should look at the elements in their life, their neighborhood, their friends.
So, I mean, there's this idea that your life has become a corporation. You're looking at what you have the way a corporation will look at its statistics and its books and so forth. You're thinking about the instead of whether you actually like your house or enjoy your neighborhood, what it represents as a paper value, and you're thinking of everything in those terms.
In these sort of disconnected abstract terms. And that's why, you know, I'm a media theorist when it comes down to it.
That's right. So you come out of your original foundation for your research is media studies and specifically the study of PR, right? Am I right about that?
Right. Media and PR are kind of in some ways one and the same at this point. I mean, I look at human beings as just consciousnesses floating around in media. Even our bodies are media. And what we're trying to do is create connections and get confirmation from other consciousnesses. And we use media to do that. You know, even the way, you know, whether I put this down here, you know, my sweatshirt down here or up here is media, you know, wearing my hood up. Communicate something. It's all, you know, my eyebrows, everything is media. So I look at
So I look wait a minute, you're complaining about everything being a corporation, but for you everything is media. So media
right.
is
everything
your
is media.
Yeah.
It really is. So then when I look at what I get interested in is when do people take a medium for granted? When do people see a medium as something as content in some ways rather than as media? When do they mistake the message for or the medium
for a
message?
Or there's this idea of the medium as an environment so that you're not actually living in the real world that your body is in, but you're in some other medium such as money or value, economic value, or
right.
something else like that.
Right.
I'd like to hear you talk about that some more. That was
right.
very – that we've lost touch with our physical environment. And I was particularly interested in that myself just because I'm so absorbed in the internet. So I'm in this virtual place all the time that's very meaningful to me. And it's not really about the exchange of any money. It's not really very economic, unfortunately.
Is why in some ways it's more real than some of our real world transactions, which are dominated by money. I mean, the original beauty of the internet was people came here kind of with their spare time, and it was a hobbyist type place, and no one could imagine anyone making money in this realm. And that's what made it so revolutionary, is that it was, you know, truly distinct from the economy. You know, and now it's sort of business as usual, where everybody's, you know, everybody's .com is a new, you know, a new potential stock market scheme. But
and there's this word monetize.
Right.
When I sign in to Blogger to blog, one of the things I could click, you really can make that money the way they would like you to monetize it. It's a way for Google to make more money by just getting lots
right.
of
and
little
scale
ads
up,
out there.
You know?
But I'm interested in this idea that in where you are, the physical place where you are, you know, Hastings on the Hudson or the edge of Appalachia or wherever we are,
right.
It's bad and wrong and soul-sucking to be in the sort of corporate version of your life. But I'm wondering how that compares to being in
right.
the internet version,
right.
like creating a place for yourself online. Because, I mean, and especially to tie it back to this idea of little villages in the Middle Ages. I mean, village, when I think of villages, there's some nice warm values that you could extol, but there's also the kind of xenophobia and the stereotypes and the racism. Right. And for example, no, gay people bad, need to go to the cities.
Bad things.
And people who are not, don't fit the form,
may
get benefits from, first of all, going to big urban areas or also being to transcend all the geographical places and go online. So it seems to me there's great value to that.
Right, right. There's many, many, there's a huge range of subjects here. But let me start, mm-hmm. let me start with the first one. The book and me over my career, what I've been interested in doing is tracing when people disconnect from the real and connect to something else, connect mm-hmm. to symbols or iconography right. instead of real things. So when do they stop buying oats from Joe and start buying it from the Quaker, and that relationship with the Quaker on the box feels more real to them and legitimate than their relationship with that person down the street. Now, for me, money is a medium. Right. And that's my initial path of inquiry. The initial reason I wrote this book was I wanted to say money is a medium. And if we analyze it like a medium, we learn all sorts of things about ourselves and money. We learn how we've mistaken it for something real. And the reason I like to go back to the Middle Ages.
And that's beautifully drawn out in the book. I just want to recommend the book to people, that you really do spell that out. And that idea that of the money as the medium is really
and
fascinating.
Right. And
I mean, we can't do as much as we need to do here, but I want to
And it goes back it goes back to almost to general semantics in a way. It's like I pull the money out. I do in my talks, I go, you know, this, you know, we think this is money. And it's not money. It's a money. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? This is a mm-hmm. kind of money. And there are other money. So once you use the is word, this is money, you're already lost. You know, there were other kinds of money. And back in the Middle Ages, mm-hmm. and I'm not mm-hmm. romantic for that period. I'm not saying that, oh, it was so much better. I'm saying that we need to understand the late Middle Ages, because only then can we understand the invention of centralized currency, the invention of chartered corporations, and what they did. It's not to say that everything back then is better than it was now, or everything non-corporate is better than everything corporate. Corporations are great. I'm glad they're here. We've got our computers. They've done some great things. But they're not the only player on the landscape. Just a centralized currency isn't the only kind of currency we could be using.
Now, could you explain most people, I think, would think that having currency means that you have a form of exchange that everyone recognizes, and it makes everything more efficient and better for everyone because we recognize this this currency as representing what it does, and then we can all exchange it. And if you had lots of different currencies, it would just be too complex. It would be inefficient.
No, it would actually be more efficient, because then you'd have different tools for different jobs. It's like saying, look, TV is great. TV is great. We all know what TV is. We all know who Walter Cronkite is. We all understand the news. Why do you want to create websites where I'm going to have to click on things and see different perspectives on the same? What are you doing here?
Why would a different currency be a different perspective?
Get this machine away from here. So that's why people do have to understand there's different tools for different jobs. Mm-hmm. You know, a hammer hammers a nail, and a screwdriver can screw in something or screw out something. You know, so you use different things for different purposes. So in the late Middle Ages, the kinds of currency that people used were mostly local currencies, and they were based in grain. So it's like what a commodity trader would now understand as commodities futures or pork bellies. They're allowed to trade in it, but most of us really don't know how or why. What would happen is you'd bring 100 pounds of grain to the grain store in town. They would give you a receipt for that grain saying, okay, here's 100 pounds of grain receipt. Then you would use that receipt to buy things in your town from other people. Mm-hmm. Now, the interesting thing about that money is it lost value over time because it was based in something real. That real thing would be eaten by rats or get spoilage. The grain store had to be paid. So this money would lose value, which actually led people to want to reinvest their money. Mm-hmm. So they kept reinvesting and spending it constantly. So this was a money, right, a medium that was biased towards spending, not towards saving. It was biased towards reinvestment. And this is why, you know, reinvestment as percent of GDP was actually the highest then than it was at any time in history. They did preventative maintenance on their windmills. They paid their workers tremendous amounts of money. People worked 4 days a week. They had 72 holidays. They had 4 meals a day. Women were taller in late Middle Ages England than they are today, and men were taller than at any time till the 1970s. People actually lived very well. At that point, this is before the plague, which actually came about after kings came and said, oh my gosh, people are using these local currencies, they're trading, they're becoming wealthy, they're investing in windmills, they're building cathedrals in these little towns, and I as king and we as the aristocracy are actually becoming less wealthy relative to this middle class that's now rising tremendously. What are we going to do? We're going to outlaw local currency and force everybody to use coin of the realm instead, mm-hmm. which we can mete out from our central bank rather than having it come out of abundance. So now we're going to have a scarcity-based currency that we can make artificially scarce rather than a currency that's based in something real. So what happened was currency, which was already derivative, right? So now here is, you start with your grain, which is something real that people know how to value. You get a grain receipt, which is basically a derivative off that grain. And now you get, those are all illegal, and you get money that comes from a king, which is it's an artificially created market for these chips. It's basically monopoly money, but now you have to trust the king to keep this scarce so that we understand what it's worth. But the scarcity is no longer based in the genuine scarcity or mm-hmm. abundance of our economy to produce. It's based on the mm-hmm. scarcity of the money market itself, which was created for rich people to be able to make money by having money. That's the purpose of this currency.
Now, one thing that an element that you're leaving out here that I think you might have left out in the book is the connection of all of this to Jews and anti-Semitism. And banking and ideas about conspiracies
and
so on. I feel like you're edging up next to that, and I'm getting a little uneasy when some of this nostalgia for the Middle Ages. I'm getting some strange vibes from that I need you to call.
Well, it wasn't the Old Testament is against usury, if that's where you want to go. And mm-hmm. the Jews were condemned to usury because they weren't allowed to own land. I mean, so the Jews were used to do the nastiest things that corporations needed and central banks needed to accomplish. I mean, that's what Jews were used for, with the canaries in the coal mine. You know, if you were not allowed to have a regular job, if you're not allowed to own land, if you're not allowed to have stuff, there you're going to have to take what job you can get. The Jews were were utilized to use this. The more interesting place to go with that, if you really want to get into some scary stuff, would be the Judeo-Christian abstraction, right? From pagan gods to an abstract God or an abstract notion of God is itself kind of derivative. If you will, it's mm-hmm. instead of worshiping these real things, you know, what we Jews call idols, now we're going to abstract God. And it was a great idea, so people don't argue about it so much, so everyone can have their own picture of God and all that. But
so God is like a common currency. The one God is like a common
currency. In some sense, one God, let's use that as a common currency and keep it abstract so that we don't sort of argue over it so much. And part of the
that
purpose
didn't work.
It was not it for the Jewish ideal. It was not for global domination, but mm-hmm. for if every in their sense, it was basic survival. You know, if everybody has an abstract God, then they may not want to kill us anymore. In other words, let's get over, because if Jews have no place to call home, then everywhere they go, they are an outsider. If they can somehow create an overarching structure through which to understand God and value, a more abstract way of understanding these things as social constructions, then maybe people would be less likely to kill them over it.
So but, I'm interested in this idea of abstraction and the way, which you seem to oppose, but abstraction is a strategic move
I
that
don't
can be used to create
it.
A chord, right? If you,
I don't
you
oppose it. What I'm
just,
saying is that it can't and it shouldn't have to exist to the exclusion of all other things. Like, it's mm-hmm. fine. If the government wants to create a big corporation with lots of guns to go and kill Native Americans and take their land and grow things, you know, that's what they're going to go do. But they can't do this to the exclusion of all other potential business models. And mm-hmm. that's where it's a problem, where we outsource and when we create rather than just creating corporations to coexist on a level playing field with small businesses, to where we create chartered monopolies to make it illegal for colonists to grow and sell cotton themselves, but to have to sell it to the British East India Trading Company, when it's illegal to make fabric or it's illegal to make clothes because there's another company that has monopoly over that. That's where we get into problems. And that's really come down to us today through the same kinds of scorched earth policies that you see, you know, a Walmart able to utilize in America because of the, you know, preconditions set up for the railroads or for the coal industry or for the earliest chartered corporations.
But now today we do have antitrust law. We don't let the corporations become monopolies.
We have antitrust law, but it doesn't work. I mean, what does it mean when a company is too big to fail? It means that it's been allowed to get too big. And the way it got too big was not through natural competition on a level playing field, but through manipulation of law and legislation through lobbying. You know, when Mattel outsources its toy manufacturing to China and a whole bunch of toys come back with lead paint on them, and so everyone gets up in arms. What happens as a result is we get legislation that favors Mattel. And what kind of legislation is this? It's legislation that makes it cost between $50,000 and $100,000 to be able to sell anything that's to be used by a child in America. Now, what does that do? It actually gives Mattel one more unfair advantage on the playing field. Now, what does a small toy manufacturer, a cottage industry of 5 people or 10 people who make, you know, $100,000 of toys all year, how can they afford $50,000 of testing for each toy that they manufacture? Because every single kind of toy needs to have its own testing procedure. So what happens is a corporation like Mattel ends up creating a dangerous product through its own outsourcing and giant sort of conglomerate behavior, and the result is legislation which ends up favoring their operations and putting every smaller one out of business. That's not antitrust law doesn't end up solving those kinds of problems.
So you're actually being critical of environmental and safety kinds of legislation as being a trick that corporations use to harness government to serve monopolistic ends.
Many times when it costs $400 million to get a drug approved, Big Pharma is not going to object to that procedure because it keeps Big Pharma in the game and everyone else out of the game. I'm all for safety. I'm all for standards and all. But I think if we end up looking at the processes that are used, we find that they in many cases are artificially expensive because only the biggest players can afford.
Yeah, I know people on the left and liberals support strong uniform national laws and so forth. And then there are people who think things should be done at a decentralized level, at the lowest level at which they can be effective. And people talk about federalism and so forth. And I'm wondering how your ideas would connect to that. Because you've talked about uniform legislation, national legislation, as something that would make it too hard for a smaller business to get to start producing toys or whatever. And so I'm wondering if you favor the nationalization of government that we've had in the last near century, or if you would go back to the more Jeffersonian model of decentralization and what we today talk about in terms of federalism.
It depends.
This is a big left-right issue, you know, and I'm trying to place you, you know, speaking of place, we were talking about this on the phone beforehand, but I'm trying to place you on the political map, left-right.
I think that the best antidote for the extreme abstraction and brandedness of most human activity is for people on the human scale to be involved in local government, local politics, in their immediate surroundings, you know, and you end up coming against national and federal policy soon enough. You know, when you're trying to get a bike lane in your town, you realize, well, who made the roads here? When you're trying to get solar panels or create alternative energy policy, you find out, oh, you know, there's a national or a state law against me feeding back into the grid. We need try to grow chard on a piece of land that's been set aside for a corn subsidy. You find out, you know, you soon enough come against the legislation that's big. But I think the only way you understand which legislation is a problem is by trying to do things in the real world. You know, and that for most of us, I think being involved in the real world that we live in is enough of a start, because it's so easy to get sidetracked and confused and led down a strange path when you just join a big Facebook group to vote against some big thing. That said, there's certainly a role for top-down, centralized legislation, especially the kind of legislation that supports the kinds of activities that real people need to do to reconnect to, you know, the schools, the food, the healthcare, the communities that actually form the fabric of their lives.
The good things, and you don't want the bad things.
Does that make sense?
Well, we all think that, right? Some things you want to be done at a uniform national level.
Yeah, is that bad?
Some things you don't. But how do you draw the line between which you want and which you don't want? Is it issue by issue, ad hoc, and you would like to control things locally? The things that you want to control locally, you would like to control locally. And anytime you see a need for something uniform to be done, like outlawing race discrimination, perhaps, or having a certain safety standard, the national level being operative.
Certain kinds of things tend to work better from the bottom up. Certain kinds of things work better from the top down, and it's a constant negotiation. And I think it's
except the top always wins because there's a national supremacy. I mean, if they want to do it from the national level, it gets done there, and then you lose the power to take it back at the local level.
I'm not necessarily the top. You know, the top wins in certain kinds of things, but you know, the part of the reason the top wins on an economic level, on a market level, is because we have a top down economy. You know, and that's really what I'm writing about is if we do have a top down economy, and if we have given, you know, monopoly currency power to the central bank, then we have to look at whether there's alternative means for creating and measuring value. You know, and that's I don't think that it's always top down against bottom up. I think that there can be, you know, a marriage of top down and bottom up, a sort of a yin and yang and a constant interplay. I mean, and yeah, it's going to be a negotiation. And sometimes we find the top down works better for something. Sometimes, you know, we find it doesn't. You know, like a woman's right to choose right now is top down. And that's really because a majority of us don't trust people in some states to preserve that right if it became a bottom up.
Yeah, but once the top gets control, it's very hard to devolve it back to a lower level. I mean, there's federal supremacy. So if the feds think they want to do it for whatever political reason, they may do it. They don't do it because they've actually rationally figured out that uniform law is better, or that they know better, or that a single standard is now known and should be imposed on everyone, including the laggards who are holding us back. They'll do it whenever they see fit in a political sense to do it. And then because of federal supremacy, that will be the standard, like, let's say, the Controlled Substances Act versus wanting to legalize marijuana. You can't take it back to the local level. Even though there are local majorities who would like to do things differently, the feds, by virtue of simply wanting to do it, are able to do it and able to control it.
Right. I mean, that's a problem. I mean, and it tends to go in one direction. You know, it's once the top down authority, be it corporate or federal, wins something, that tends to be permanent. And that's why you have this slow evolution or a slow march towards corporate power in America. They're patient. They wait. They live forever. You know, so they wait and wait. If it takes them a century to get, you know, the rights of individuals to be enjoyed by corporations, then they'll wait a century or two until they get it. And once they get it, it's very hard to wrest that from them.
But the other side of that is the idea of individual rights. You mentioned the right to abortion. There is this idea that there are greater things that should endure and that do belong to the individual and that you can't take them away. And that's considered a good thing, that we have this right, that it's protected at the national level, and it's not going to be sent back to the states. I mean, that's the idea of a right, that it is something that endures, that's considered a good thing. So this idea, this idea that there are things that are not, these questions about scale are very interesting in the book. This idea that maybe because corporations and governments have this huge scale in geographic and time spans, that they can do things that dwarf us as individuals. But when we think about individual rights, we think of that in a good way, that the endurance and the grand scale of those things is something that protects us and is good for us. We don't have to fight for it at local levels and be constantly involved with convincing other people and interacting with other people. You know, I mean, to some extent, this connection with neighbors, which is a big issue in your book, is something that maybe we don't want. I may not like my neighbors. I may want arm's length and some big principles and abstractions to protect me over time and in a kind of an ironclad permanent way. I mean, there's a good side to that that protects people. Now, I know that in your book also individualism is kind of a dirty word, that individual is kind of a trick or a ruse that corporations use in a way that actually hurts us.
Right.
And maybe I want to give you a chance to explain that. Is individualism some kind of a deceit or trick?
Well, I mean, I think that
bad, but I like being an individual, and I like my individual rights, and I like them at a uniform and permanent scale that's beyond the scale of the human scale of the village and so forth. Am I wrong?
Not necessarily. I mean, there's things that we like about individuality, but romantic or enlightenment infatuation with individual liberties and individual rights and individual perspectives has really been exploited. And we've, you know, while we may have evolved at one point or elevated from subject to citizen, I think we rapidly devolved from citizen to consumer and consumer to shareholder. And that we begin to think of ourselves as individuals competing for scarce resources on a business landscape rather than people capable of sharing resources on an abundant landscape. You know, and we have a ton of science and a ton of economics which is trying to support this, I would argue, false notion of human beings as an essentially competitive species, where the better science, the people like Glenn Isaac, show that what made human beings human, what allowed us to survive over our competitors on the natural landscape, was our food sharing abilities, was the fact that we could tribalize, that we could pool resources and do things with one another. By being a social animal, we were able to accomplish things we couldn't otherwise. And that the individuation that we celebrate, certainly in America right now, is not really so much about your real autonomy or agency to choose the kind of life you want to live, but to choose between the consumer products that corporations can offer us. That the more individualized we are, the more each one of us needs to buy each thing. That's, you know, back to Levittown, the idea of keeping every nuclear family separate, making sure there's not room for grandma or extended family in the house, so that everyone would have to purchase everything. You know, you don't share one barbecue pit at the end of the block. That's for poor people. What real Americans do is everyone buys their own Weber grill. And that's a great thing for the grill company. And it's a great thing for an economy that needs to expand. But it's not necessarily a great thing for the barbecue. No, not everyone has to be friends with people. You can live alone. You can watch TV, you can work from home, you can never see another person if that's really what you want to do. But I would argue that that kind of isolated living is not the way everyone wants to live, and not even the way a majority of us want to live, but a way that's encouraged and supported by an intrinsically alienating economic landscape that forces competition and consumption over collaboration.
Can
and
I
sharing.
Ask you just one more question? Since I had to do two recordings, now I'm off on how much time we've been talking. Can you see how long we haven't gone over? Are we approaching an hour at this point? I'll ask you one more question.
Let me see.
See the little number there over on the.
Well, we're okay. Got to be around.
Well, let me
an
ask
hour.
You one little question, and
we're 49
minutes. Okay, well, good
time
for one more question. I'll let you bring this in for landing. This is all very interesting, okay. And I want to. I'm holding up the book for the camera one more time. Life Incorporated by Douglas Rushkoff. Really interesting book with lots in it, more than we've been able to talk about. I love the section on advertising. Actually, before I went to law school, I worked at J. Walter Thompson Advertising Agency, so I sort of I'm very interested in the advertising that you talk about, the consumer being kind of a way toward individualism, phony individualism and creativity through the use of prefab meaning systems in brand name products and so forth. And this kind of stood in a contrast to religion. And you compare that to religion at one point and say that religion's original intent was different, that religion really is about finding deep meaning. And then we've substituted for that a kind of a prefab meaning that is in products, which I kind of thought that there's a lot of power and oppression in religion, and maybe prefab meaning in products is sort of liberated and not really liberating and not really all that bad. But I want to encourage you to talk about that.
Well, I don't actually use the term prefab in it, but I know what you mean. I mean, I've spent a lot of time with people who attempt to invest brands with mythologies, mm-hmm. you know, and it's part of what you do if you're trying to sell a product rather than based on the attributes. If the attributes of the products are basically the same, how do you convince people that this pair of tennis shoes to buy that one instead of this one? And you do it by investing the brand with meaning. And people understand this. They understand that, you know, a Puma and a Nike and an Airwalk, you know, may be basically the same product, but that by wearing one brand over another and people see what sneaker you're wearing, you're communicating mm-hmm. something, right? You're saying something about the world and your perspective on the world. And a kid's, you know, or more than usually an adult's collection of brand iconography is a way of communicating their relationship to the world, mm-hmm. their relationship to meaning, the way they make meaning. And a lot of the people I know who work with brands really believe that brands have become a new the universe of brand iconography is equivalent to, perhaps even superior to, the realm of icons and meaning that people used in earlier centuries, you know, with religion and spirituality and all. And it is possible that they're right. Right. And that Nike and
Airwalk, on one hand, it seems crude to find meaning in products. Or, I mean, they're trying to make money, but are you saying that they actually believe that it is good? And we might believe that it is good.
Oh, sure, they believe it. And that's and it's okay. And I met them. They know, you know, like, you know, Douglas mm-hmm. Atkin, who wrote a book on cult branding, that he believes it's the same thing. So that, you know, the cross and Jesus and the Jewish star, you know, is the same as a Nike swoosh. It's just a different century. Now, the only question I have to raise is if the function of the brand is really to generate money, you know, is that the same? The question we have to ask is whether religious icons and religious iconography at any point in its development, was anybody investing it with anything other than the need to control people, you know, the need to send people to war? If no, then, you know, then he's right. Then what's the difference between creating an image that's just supposed to control people versus one that's just supposed to make them buy stuff? Then, you know, then none. And maybe the wink, wink disconnection we have towards current brand iconography, our ability to recognize it as social construction, makes it part of our, you know, continuing ascendance, you know, that we're actually transcending this iconography. But I would argue that There have been meaning systems in the past that when meaning systems are created for reasons other than the market, for reasons other than just stimulating consumption, that there's potentially more to it, that it's possible, not necessary, it's possible that Judaism as a system of thought holds more potential meaning and ethos that could serve people than Bionicles or Bounty. It's possible that it doesn't, and I'll grant the upside, that it doesn't.
The upside is greater,
but I do
the
believe there were human beings who invested these systems with something other than the need to buy that might make them serve other purposes.
Yeah, but I mean the upside is obviously greater, but the downside is also greater. The depth of the meaning in religion is something that makes it very powerful and also very dangerous. If our human need for meaning is transferred into products and we're simply operating in the market and we try to make some money and then buy some products with brands that make us feel something about ourselves and that's our little world of meaning, we're pretty innocuous. At least we're not causing really big troubles. We're not, committing genocide
it's okay, but it's a problem if people don't understand that all of the iconography is existing on the landscape of a market, rather than on the mixed landscape of human society or human culture.
So maybe all we need is to just know that and become savvy. I mean, we're not dumb. For example, with respect to advertising, we've learned to laugh at them. We've learned to speed by them. There's some interplay. There's our human intelligence pushing back. It's not ironclad. We may know it's a market and we may want to buy things anyway. We may want to resist or fund those things. We can be smart and savvy and sophisticated as we deal with the market.
We can, but we still live in an economy where when the institutions that were put in place, if we understand them, to extract wealth from us are the first things we run to fund when the system stops working. That most simply, we are living in an economic Ponzi scheme that's being driven by a debt-based currency. And when it starts to teeter, when it starts to crack, what we do is we spend our grandchildren and great-grandchildren's tax money to bail out the institutions that have really had the same ultimate impact on it that Bernie Madoff had on his investors. And our inability to see the such simpler way out of that mess, to me, bespeaks an unconsciousness. It bespeaks a belief in the market that we're living in as a real thing rather than a construction that's gone awry.
Wow. Well, I'm tempted to ask you another question, but I know you have another interview and I know we've probably gone too long at this point, so I'm going to have to let you go. And that was great.
It's great talking to you too. I'd love to talk to you again. There's a lot I want to learn from you about law.
Okay.
But I'll continue reading your multiple blogs now.
Okay.
And talk to you soon.
Okay. So. Okay. Good luck.
Thanks
with the book.
A lot.
Bye-bye.